Hello, everybody. Chris Martinson here. And today we're going to be talking about finance and economics as part of Finance U. Remember, anything that you see in this video and all resources available at our websites or affiliated websites are not intended as or construed as financial advice. This is for educational purposes. Remember, if you have a financial decision, please consult a financial professional. We are not attorneys. We're not CPAs. We are not financial managers. As well, we do our best to be accurate. And everything we represent is as accurate as we know it to be. Now, let's turn to our program.
Somebody out there became price insensitive and knew that they were going to drive it out to all-time highs and create extra competitors for those that are paying attention to those things. But they saw something in the system, whatever that may be, that made them decide not to wait for a potential pullback.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Finance U. I am Chris Martinson, your host with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Hey, Paul, how are you?
Hi, Chris. I'm doing well. Good to see you today.
Well, later on, we'll talk about the new cows that just showed up at our farm, but we're going to talk about finance stuff here today. Yes. So lots going on. The Fed flapped their gums today, which, of course, is always means the stocks have to go up. But the Fed is working very hard to try and make sure that stocks never go down. That seems to be their job. That annoys me to no end because that's not their job, but they've taken it on as a surrogate third mandate. Make sure stocks are always jawboned higher. Paul, I'm getting lots and lots of signs now and from the edges that things aren't as robust as we've been told. We've been scolded that, you know, you should be happy with the so-called Biden economy and how strong it is. But we have data now that maybe they've comprehensively and possibly corruptly overstated jobs. The strong jobs market is not as strong as advertised, that maybe they've been fibbing about a variety of things. Fibbing in the BLS has been a problem in every administration, but this is worse than anything I've seen so far. There's lying, and then there's this stuff that's been going on. It's pretty bad. It's off the reservation. So from your perspective, What are you detecting in your clients? Are people really feeling the pinch like they are in my neck of the woods? Because people are starting to squeal a little here.
Oh yeah, I mean today. So I did a little local TV show this morning, and I ran by the farm feed store on my way in, and good friend, family friend, I've known him for a long time, apologized to me before they gave me the total, and she said, "Paul, I am so sorry." And I said, "Is it that bad?" And she said, "Yeah." She said, "Prices are going up so fast." She said, "Everybody that comes in here is complaining. They're changing their behaviors. They're cutting out everything that they can." You know, my son and I had a conversation last night. I got home, got out on the farm. It was a beautiful day. He called and he said, "Dad," and he's doing well. Like, he literally just passed his general contractor's license. So in Georgia, he's 25. He's the youngest unlimited, you know, general contractor license in the state of Georgia. They told him that after it was over, so I was proud for him. He said, "Dad, I'm doing good." He said, "But I feel like I can't get ahead. Like, it's like everything is going up so quickly." And then he starts complaining about just how expensive the labor is in the construction process right now, how expensive electrical materials are. And they're ridiculously busy, but he's like, if we make a mistake on a bidding process, we're in trouble. And so that's the common theme that I'm hearing everywhere. And what's really interesting to me is, you know, you started out talking about they're lying. They're fibbing on the numbers. In our kindness, we want to say they're fibbing on the numbers. But I had somebody that I know came up to me today and they started paying attention. They made a comment about, how the government's just painting this rosy picture and their plastic face, you know, not telling the truth. And I looked at him and I said, "So you know they're lying, right?" He said, "Absolutely, I know they're lying now." I said, "Do you believe that they know that you know that they're lying?" And he said, he thought about it for a minute. He said, "Yeah, you're right. I think they are, you know, they don't even care anymore. Like we know they're lying. They know they're lying and they're lying anyway." So, I just can't see it any other way in the data, but that's the common theme everywhere I'm going right now. And especially retirees are really feeling the pressure. insurance cost, home insurance cost. I mean, in 26 years of working with people, I've never heard anybody really complain about their home insurance, you know, unless they were already in trouble. But, you know, consistently complaining about it, car insurance, you know, just across the board. I believe people are really feeling the pinch.
Well, insurance is something that first you have to have it, right? You can't carry a mortgage without it. You can't drive a car without it, et cetera, right? And it's been absolutely minimum 20% and as high as 70% is the increase that I've fielded from people this year. And this is personal experience plus other people who've told me, wow, my home insurance went up 70% this year, right? Mm-hmm. For no good reason. It's not like, you know, they suddenly moved into a tornado alley or something. It's just happening and there's no explanation given. Everybody just sort of shrugs and says, well, I guess that's just what it is. But why would insurance be spiking that hard? Why would home insurance go up 70% in a year?
Yeah, that's insane. And they're staying on top of it, right? Like this is something that the actuarials spend a lot of time trying to pay attention to and calculate. And they don't make 70% mistakes in 1 year. And, you know, mm-hmm. and another thing that's coming along at the end of this year too. So, you know, real estate kind of slowed down at the end of the year last year. And we're seeing some data like construction jobs came out and had the largest decline in the data that came out here recently. Largest decline in the data. And I think the data goes back to 1994. But in our area, we've had a resurgence of real estate prices again. Like everybody was kind of on the fence last year, but there's kind of like panic buying out there. And I want to come back to that in a minute because mm-hmm. the belief that interest rates are going to go down, people I think are making mistakes or potentially making mistakes. But now you're going to have real estate taxes are going to increase again at the end of this year as well, at least for those in the North Georgia area. And people are already concerned and worried about what that bill is going to be. So these are conversations that, you know, because typically if I'm working with somebody, they've done a good job saving money. You know, they have assets. They've accumulated some wealth. They've made sacrifices in the past so that they could be in the position that they're in today. And they'll complain because people are tight from time to time. But I've never heard this many people in consistent conversation without me bringing it up, complain about the cost of living.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm fielding the same stuff here. I'd love to hear in the comments down below if anybody else is noticing the same thing. I'd be surprised if you aren't. And it's not really being talked about. So it's not just that, you know, we know the government is lying and they know that we know that they know that we know. But the mainstream media does the same thing, Paul, that all the time. I watch them just make such basic category errors in their reporting that it's impossible to say, they're that dumb. You can't be that dumb, right? You can't be that, right? So I just did something for my subscribers this morning. I think part of this went out public too, talking about how in the UK, they're just having bad weather. The rainiest start in the last 18 months that they've had in the entire data series going back to 1836. So they put the potatoes in the ground if they can even get them in the ground and they're rotting and they couldn't get last year's parsnips out. So they're having a really bad food season. So they're saying, oh, you know, this is climate change. That's what they're blaming it on, is going to cause food prices to skyrocket here. And they left out the fact that food prices are already high because of inflation due to central bank and government printing. Like it's obviously both things, but they never talk about one of them, right? Inflation is just this mysterious, food prices just, we don't know, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's vexing to me because it's not that hard. It's a very easy story to tell, which is why we're here telling it all the time. You know, inflation is because somebody printed too much money.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it works.
Well, and I think the hard part for the average individual out there is they've heard about the government printing money for the longest time after the 2008 crisis with no major impact, right? So you had this slow increase in asset prices that made people feel wealthy. When you go back mm-hmm. through history, I'm losing the quote right now, but it starts out, you know, how do you go bankrupt slowly then all at once? That inflation starts out feeling good to begin with, and then all at once and suddenly it becomes an overwhelming force in society. So I don't think people, they were like, you know, those of us that were warning about this leading to the situation that we're in now and potentially worse, we're like, oh yeah, whatever. So now we're getting here and they're starting to open their eyes and really had the courage to see the world with the truth and accept the truth and realize, hey, this is something that our government is doing. And it appears to be intentional for whatever reason.
Now, speaking of those category errors related to this, you mentioned it already. I think people are making a mistake who think that interest rates are going to go down from here. Now, we all know that the Fed wants them to go down and they're just waiting for any sort of an excuse. And that if they'd had the right data, they would have made the, you know, cuts already. They haven't been able to. We're already, you know, we can see the first half of the year right through our windshield. And we're not going to have any cuts in the first half. And I don't think we're going to have any cuts in the second half because of what I'm seeing out there right now. There's the inflation is just not going away and it's getting worse. And I don't think they can cut. I don't think they can do it, Paul, not in an election year. I know they want to badly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the announcement came out today that the quantitative tightening taper, you know, a statement is here. They're reducing their issuance, you know, push. Because what they do is they tighten it by putting it into the market, raises interest rates, lower their balance sheet. They're reducing that by about $60 billion, if I remember correctly. Let me look at the number here.
Yeah, so just to be clear, so quantitative tightening.
No, $60 billion to $25 billion. Excuse me, go ahead and you can.
Right. It had been $60 billion a month, but just so everybody's following along. So the Federal Reserve has a balance sheet where they have treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. They're sitting on there. They're sitting there. They could do tightening by taking some of those off and selling them into the market and taking the cash back out. That would be real tightening. What they've been doing instead is soft tightening where they've just been letting them roll off, meaning the bond comes due and it was going to get retired anyway. And so they just accept the cash for that. Yes, it technically pulls cash out of the market, but it's not the same as forcing a bond out and stripping, right, strip mining cash back out, right? Because that comes from some participant in the system, but when a treasury rolls off, that money comes from the U.S. Treasury Department, right? Mm-hmm. When a mortgage-backed security rolls off, that comes through the MBS system, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just different. So is that what they're doing? Are they just gonna reduce the amount of, they're gonna roll more of the bonds rather than let them roll off? That's it. They're just gonna be sucking slightly less cash out from the U.S. Treasury and also from the MBS market system.
It appears that right? way. It appears that okay. way. You know, one of the commentators that I read, I didn't get to dig into the whole report, but essentially made the comment, says, yeah, the Fed is basically admitting to those who understand what's taking place behind the surface that interest rates are just too high. And from their perspective, but when you look at it from an inflationary standpoint, you know, at this point, it doesn't seem to be slowing that down. And where I was going to go with the comment that you made, I was thinking about it for the past week or so, just been rolling around in my mind. It's like, okay, what's the perception in the market and what is the market anticipating? What is it that we are all subconsciously anticipating that we may not necessarily believe? So, you know, and I listen to individuals and having conversations, real estate agents are saying, hey, go ahead and buy your house now because we have a structural shortage in housing. You know, they lay all this data out there. So go ahead and buy the house now so that you get it. And then when the Federal Reserve slams rates back to zero again, you can just refinance at lower rates. Okay. So you've got people that are moving, and if they have the ability to borrow, and you know what, one thing that I explain a lot, especially to younger investors that come in, there are things that you can pay for that you cannot afford. Right. So, you know, people can, you know, just because you can make that payment, unless you really take a look at your budget and you're running details, you can't afford to do that because it's going to dramatically impact your lifestyle. But people are taking this risk right now. So what if, you know, and I don't know what's going to happen, but what if they don't cut interest rates? What if inflation is sticky enough because of the still supply chain disruptions, everything that's taking place, just money bubbling around the world? What if those rates don't go down? What's going to happen to those borrowers, or those potential foreclosures that are coming in the future? You look at the market's foaming at the mouth and ignoring all of the warning signs under the surface with the continued slowing of the economy, the slowing of the job market. Yes, it's slow, but it can accelerate really quickly. You know, and the market's anticipating the Fed's going to come to the rescue. And we may have this wake up moment at some point in the future that, that the markets have a violent reaction. So I was thinking about this today. You know, I was talking about, it's the Magnificent Seven, you know, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, you know, if those roll over, we might, you know, watching, we're seeing some of that happen with those stocks. It may in the rearview mirror be the magnificent countdown to a dramatic change in the everything bubble at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, just to speak to that, it just annoys me to no end, Paul, that the Fed makes a little statement and they change a couple words and they say they're going to roll stuff off. And then the whole market responds like Pavlov's bell got rung and they all start salivating. And I know that, and it just drives me nuts. And I know you know this, but just for everybody's, this is the response after the Fed made their little flappy gum thing. The Dow Jones, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, the Russell, the Nikkei, everybody's just spiking higher, right? Because, well, you know, that's fun. But you know what's not? Oil. No. Oil got slammed hard because it was a build. And I thought it was weird that it had such a hard slam on a so-called build in inventory today, because we also imported 1 million barrels per day more over this past week than we did the prior week. So, of course, you get a build when you have an aggressive import cycle. But it doesn't matter. They interpreted that as bearish. We have, you know, big inventory builds as economy is slowing, however you want to interpret it. But then it's not responding at all over here to that Fed flappy gum, you know, happy days are here again. So this is what I don't like, is it feels too contrived to me, because what the Fed would want is they want oil down because that helps bring inflation down, which is in their interest. They want stocks up because that makes everybody happy and they like that. And they want bonds to respond a certain way. And they want, so this has just been, this really feels stage managed to me, as stage managed as a Biden administration labor fib. And I'm going to use that word you used, right? You know, so that's the world we live in. So how do you navigate a world where you have suspicions that we're not exactly dealing with what we would call free, fair, open market pricing mechanisms?
Well, with one trembling step after the other, what we have to deal with it here is like, you know, at what point does it matter? At what point does it become common knowledge that the average investor walks away from? Is it 24 months from now? Is it 24 days from now? Is it 36 months from now? Right. So kind of like a pilot in instrument rating, when you've got your government that's essentially distorting the truth across the board, it's like that pilot who's flying and trying to land in Atlanta in the middle of a hurricane. So the way we utilize our tools is the weight of the evidence is, okay, let's look at the money flow. Let's look at support levels. Let's look at what different asset prices are doing. And I've learned to do this over the years, but listen to the news and pay attention to it, but then put it out of your mind when you're looking at the instrument panel so that it can kind of help guide what you're doing in the investment portfolio. So that way you're not stuck in one position going, this has got to matter tomorrow, going back to that having to play the game by the rules that are forced upon us. But they successfully kick the can down the road or manipulate this for another 24 months until it becomes common knowledge. So that's the challenging part. And where we are right now, you know, what's amazing to me is I actually marked on my chart, I made a comment on the investment committee today. I said, hey, the market, you know, the S&P sold off, rallied, and broke this short-term trend line, which is a good indication, historically speaking, that the market's going to sell off. So I said, my comment was, I'll be highly surprised if the Fed doesn't do something to juice the markets today. Because typically when you get a breakdown in those levels, they have some type of speaking event, they'll announce something. And, you know, at first I looked at it and I thought, well, interest rates are the same. That surprised me. Maybe they're not. And then you hear about the change in the quantitative tapering and I'm like, ah, that's it right there. That's it. And that seems to be the one thing that caused the market to start surging higher, because they're saying, hey, okay, they're closer to, you know, flooding the system with liquidity again. And it may not necessarily be by lowering rates, but it may be by, you know, back to quantitative easing again at some point in the future.
Yeah. And goose the markets, they did. These are the brontosaurus formations here, you know, but that's how it is. Every time the Fed opens its mouth and flaps its gums, we got a market spike. So it's literally, it's that Pavlovian conditioning, ding, 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 you know, and off we go again. So I don't, whatever. It's the game. It's the game we have to play, but it makes it really hard to sort of figure out what's what. And here's the thing. So I did this for my subscribers recently too, is like, you know, what bothers me is things that are unfair, right? I don't like unfair. And so just to tell you how deeply seated this is for me, when they came out with all their PPP loans, mm-hmm. I took none of them, right? Because I didn't need them and it wasn't right. And why should I be getting a free handout from the government? Because anyway, so I didn't participate. And then of course I feel stupid because all the congressmen took them and everybody took them and hedge funds took them and all that. But it was the right decision for me because it wasn't right. You know, it wasn't right. I didn't need them, so I didn't take them, right? And that felt right. Of course, I don't live in that culture. I live in a different one. But, you know, leaving that aside. But what bothers me is that they play their little shenanigans, Paul, all the time. And the producers get nothing out of this story. So corn price today is the same as it was in 2008 per bushel. Nominal, not inflation adjusted. I'm saying it's the same dollars per bushel in 2008. Imagine telling your school district, hey, we're going to roll your salaries back and freeze them at 2008. They'd scream bloody murder because, of course, they wouldn't be able to survive, right? So the producers get like nothing out of this, but they're doing that to oil right now. Mm-hmm. They're doing this to natural gas. Natural gas rigs are falling off like crazy because people can't drill at this $2 thing. And it's just, anyway, this just eventually comes back and gives us a lot of trouble. Copper, same story. Literally every single thing. And it's because if you show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. And how are you incentivized to expand production when you're getting the same price today that you did 10, 15, and in some cases almost 20 years ago?
Yeah. Well, not only that, just the political environment behind, if they make too much money, then the politicians are going to try to have special taxes and clawbacks. And how in the world do you reinvest into an infrastructure heavy business when you've got political pressure against you, media pressure against you, you know, and then and a force that's in there. And then, you know, a lot of that, you think about these farmers, the big institutions have come in and buying up this farmland and using institutional money so they can compete at lower prices. And no wonder your family farm is going away, right? No wonder your family farm is not able to survive. Taxes are going up. Property values are going up. You know, tractor costs have gone up substantially. It's,
but this is a war. This is a war on the family farmers. And, you know, and maybe it's just a corporate war and it's just business by some other name, but the thing that bothers me, if you give a corn farmer a 2% profit margin and that's all he's allowed or she's allowed, and then we go, oh, but you know, we're really worried about climate change and the health of the planet. Like if you don't give the person who's touching the earth a fair buffer to work with, they can't afford to do the right thing. So you can't complain about their farming practices if you give them a 2% margin, because they don't have any margin. They don't have, it's not like, oh, I'll just let the fields lie fallow this year. Oh, you know what? I won't use that toxic spray because, you know, it'll be better for people. Yields will be down 15%, but it's better for everybody, including the world and the environment. They can't do that.
No.
Right?
No.
So that's what I don't like. We got the hypocrisy of flapping our gums. Oh, we care about the world, you know, and then you let these systems run, which just crush the farmers. It's,
well,
it just doesn't make sense.
And the frustrating thing is you know, I pay very close attention to what people say, and I also pay very close attention to what people don't say, especially if they know the rest of the data. And one of the things about this government is, you know, there's a lot that they're not saying, and there's a lot that they're saying that's a sliver of the truth, but it's a lie in the big picture with what they're not saying, because they're not giving people the full truth, you know, and it seems to be a lot worse. What was it around 2013 that the Obama administration removed the bill or law, the rule that kept the government from using propaganda on the American people? I can't remember exactly when that was. Somewhere around 2000, maybe it was 2012, 14, just the general area, but that's gone now. And, you know, and it's so easy to see some of the propaganda that's in the system right now, but the average person's either too busy trying to make ends meet, you know, stressed out about trying to keep up with the rent as it's increased, or find a home, and you know, still what, 70-75% of the population, I can't remember because we talked about that a couple of weeks ago, that data, can't afford the median home price. And, you know, and it's pretty simple. If the Fed would stop trying to artificially hold everything up, let the market settle back down to what's a normal historical valuation, that would peel that money out of the market. And yeah, there's going to be some players that are over leveraged that are going to pay a price for that. But, you know, I would much rather do it in a controlled environment than an uncontrolled environment, because the one straw that breaks the camel's back, you know, and that suddenly happens. And, you know, and another thing I'm concerned about, you look at our national debt, it seems to have gone exponential at this point. So when you look at that as well, what's that going to do to your average retiree that has these bonds that are maturing in 2035 and 2040 and 2045, because that's all the only way that they could get higher yields. And if these rates stay higher for longer, then they're, you know, they're in trouble, because those bonds are going to go down in value and their income's not going to keep up. They can't sell them because they're going to have to sell them at a loss to somebody that's going to get the market yield at the time. You know, there are so many things that are running at maximum efficiency without taking the time to service the engine. It sure seems like we're much closer to seizing up sooner rather than later.
Well, we are. And so let's talk about the story right now. So we all know that we're on an unsustainable trajectory with respect to that debt. Even Jerome Powell has said as much, right? So this is open common knowledge now to anybody who wants to read about it. Our debts are increasing, not just at the federal government, but as a nation, are increasing at a level that's a lot faster than the underlying economy. Okay, so that's just a math problem. So eventually you have to resolve the question, who's going to eat the losses? Mm-hmm. Paul, the normal answer to that is this inflation we're talking about, because it steals from the many to give to the few. It's a reverse Robin Hood organization. That's who the Federal Reserve actually is. They are a reverse Robin Hood organization. They want to steal a little bit from everybody, because that's what it is. When my dollar doesn't buy this year what it bought last year, where'd it go? It was stolen, right? So, okay. Now, they'll run that unless that breaks. And if that breaks on them, we know that you have to let one of two things go in this story. Either the dollar has to go or the bond market has to go. Can't defend both. No. The Fed will always defend the bond market and the stock market. They'll let the dollar go. Okay. If that goes far enough, now what do you do? This is where we get down to everything we discussed in The Great Taking. I want to remind everybody, we've got an incredible webinar on The Great Taking, June 15th. It'll be live, but recorded, so you can see it after the fact. Paul, you're going to be there. We'll have David Rogers Webb there. We're going to have a lawyer who knows this whole area very deeply, intimately, to answer questions. We're going to have Suzanne Trimbath there, and we'll have Damian Lupo talking about a EQRP, which is a type of an IRA, all these different solutions for people, because I think that they're going to do this inflation thing, but if it gets away from them, they'll pull that Great Taking trigger. Bonk, that's what it was installed for. Just in case plan A doesn't work out, plan B. We're going to snipe this thing and take what we can, because that's the world we live in. The same people who took the PPP loans who shouldn't have their finger on the trigger. That's who we're up against here.
Yeah, it's certainly concerning. And they've been able to get away with it for quite some time. You know, going back to the late 1990s, I remember at the end of the 1990s bubble, you know, CNBC would be talking about Alan Greenspan's briefcase, right? You know, and he would speak and move the markets. I mean, just think about the power those people feel. You know, I can only imagine they go home and say, hey, look, did you see what the market did today? I created this much wealth by the comment that I made. And
yeah.
So yeah, I mean, that's a very concerning thing. You know, the Great Taking, you've done such a wonderful job educating people about that. We look in there, it's like, okay, why would you build this into the system? Because it's more than, you know, at first I was like, hopefully this was the simplest way for them to do it, right? But then you look at all of the effort that went into putting everything else around, it's not necessarily the most simple way to do it. You know, and especially, you know, what's interesting, think about how popular options have become here recently. I mean, every retail individual is into options now. Like I run around, used to, when I was studying options, you know, 10, 12, 15 years ago, and ultimately came to the conclusion not to utilize them because I was concerned about the derivative exposure when Buffett made his famous comment years ago, you know, derivatives, which are options or weapons of mass financial destruction. So there's really no safety net. And I was worried about, okay, what good is it to have a put on your portfolio if the counterparty fails and you don't have that protection? But that's the most popular thing in retail now. You know, you go on an Uber, you go wherever, it's like, hey, I'm using options, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And people are sharing those, that talk. And that, based on this, the information that we have so far, is the greatest area of risk. So, you know, the system's set up there, and it's not like that has the level of protections, you know, because we've not had an options market blow up. The reason we ended up with FDIC insurance is because of what happened in the Great Depression. The banks blew up. Okay, well, we didn't see that coming. You should have seen it coming. So let's put in FDIC insurance. Well, let's put SIPC insurance in place. You know, so I think it's going to be important to be able to talk about that and at least give people options on what they can prudently do to protect themselves.
Yeah, let me see if I can find this real quick. I'm pretty sure I can find this. Was that it? No. No. Shoot. Yeah, here it is. See what you think about this one. I found this a little odd. So this came out in Reuters just 6 days ago, and it's a Howe Jones article. It says, regulators told to be ready to handle failed clearinghouses. This is coming out of London Byline for some reason. I'm not clear why that would be, but it says, regulators must equip themselves with tools such as bail-in bonds to quickly deal with a failed clearinghouse. So the clearinghouse would be the clearing party, say, that would be the intermediary between you and the option seller or buyer, depending where you are in that thing. So for stocks, bonds, or derivatives, without having to call on taxpayers for cash, so they're like, why are they suddenly getting ready for a clearing party failure? And this would be the kind of thing that would trigger that great taking if you had something like that. They're talking all the stuff we've been talking about, the great taking series, the Financial Stability Board is invoked in here. I was kind of surprised to read that come through because as David Webb and also this lawyer, Jimmy Lovely, explained to me, it's not just that they're worried about, say, a failure of a node like that clearing party. It's that there's a whole settlement system, and the Fed now is the defender of that system. You can't have the system fail, and that's what they're really trying to protect. And so when you see things like them saying, oh, we've decided to taper QT, 9 times out of 10, if you dig deep enough, you will find that there was some creaking, popping, blowing up underneath, which said, oh, we got to stop that right now. Not because it was the right thing to do necessarily for you or me or full employment or inflation or the next generation. It's because part of the system was creaking and growing, and they had to relieve the pressure on the system. So we have this massive system that nobody really understands, and it's just doing what it does, and it's vacuuming vast amounts of wealth from Party A into Party B's pockets. And according to this article, they're getting a little worried about things.
Yeah. And I always think it's interesting when they start putting that out there, right? Like I always like to pay attention to the back page of the Wall Street Journal because it starts in the back and works its way to the front. You know, it's interesting that they put that out there. Well, not only that, Chris, the information's out there enough now. And I know other governments know this, but you know, when we're this fiscally weak, economically weak, like, you know, if the Fed's that desperate to keep the markets up, I'm, you know, really think about it. If our economy can't handle a 50% decline in the stock market, okay, how resilient are we, right? Because people should have savings. They should be able to survive an interim period if we're levered to that deep. I mean, don't get me wrong. That's very painful for people who are too aggressively invested or don't have a risk management associated with it. But that's not something that's uncommon throughout history. So if our system is running that tight and it's that weak under the surface that we can't handle it, then what's there to stop an international government finding that weak link inside of there and triggering a domino on the other side, right? Because if you can utilize options and other tools like that to suppress certain prices or start gamma squeezes, then you should theoretically be able to start a gamma squeeze, which is a technical option, but you know, trigger in the market that could cause a series of events to start unraveling. I don't know that we're there, but those are things that I think about when there's this much desperation behind the systems to keep the market up.
Yeah. I mean, they sure have been desperate, though, right? I mean, it's just like constant interventions and like you and I, as betting men who've been watching the markets, had a big down day yesterday, but you and I both knew that the chance of that following through today,
yeah,
that wasn't even money odds. There was a good chance that things are going up and going up strong today because of something, right?
That's right.
And that's just, yeah. So again, how did we get into this position where now the whole system is so fragile that the keepers of it are terrified of allowing any sort of weakness to develop because that could unravel the whole ball?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fine. But I think you and I and everybody listening to this need to be cognizant of that fact. The fact that they put that much effort into making sure that no weakness can be displayed tells me how weak the system actually is and says, well, we better be prepared for that, right?
That's right.
Just got to be ready for it.
And hey, and here's the thing. What concerns me the most is they can say, well, we warned you about it. We put an article out that said that this is a problem. Why didn't you pay attention to that and do something about it, right? That's what worries me when this starts working its way into the back page and regulators are all of a sudden talking about something like this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, why is it they're talking about it now? You know, it could be that they want to start putting this information out there and it may be another 24 months before it unfolds, or maybe they think it's, you know, around the corner. My concern is there seems to be so much effort being put into trying to prop everything up into the election. You know, the question is what happens on the other side of that? And can they continue? You know, neither candidate is fiscally responsible. So, you know, what's going to happen? Is this a game of chicken where, hey, if I lose, we're handing you an engine that's about to seize up and we're hoping that you're going to get blamed for it? Or if I win, hey, we're still in control for another 4 years, so we'll deal with the aftermath on the other side of that. I don't know if that's the case, but I've just been thinking about that lately because we are seeing some deterioration under the surface, and we're seeing this intervention, obviously, with inflation continuing to stay sticky. You know, they can't just slam rates to zero because you're going to have asset prices explode, you know, higher and this inflation get out of control. So, you know, they seem to have finally painted themselves into a corner where there's no easy way to get out.
There is no easy way out. Well, maybe there is. Don't you have a cartoon to that effect about Japan?
For those out there watching, when I show this, I knew Chris would like this. I saw that. So can you see that, Chris?
Yep. Bank of Japan. Print yen, buy yen. I'll do both.
I saw that. Michael Aria, I don't even know how to pronounce his last name, Aria. He puts out some wonderful data, and I've followed him for years, and I saw that this morning, and I just started laughing. So that is a good point. That is a good point. And, if you have to sacrifice your currency to stay in power and you want power that much, that hurts the American people. And that's the thing that concerns me the most. You know, a lot of people just don't know that they're feeling the impact of inflation. They're starting to be worried that it's going to continue, but they really don't know what to do with it. Modern portfolio theory, you know, is not set up, you know, to deal with an inflationary environment. This is a new thing that really came along in the 1990s, and it was originally designed for institutions. So the argument's always been, because interest rates were in a secular downtrend from the late, you know, 1982 till now, stocks go down, bonds go up. So you're protected and you're diversified. But what did we see different in 2022? Stocks went down 20%, bonds went down 20%. That's a highly likely outcome if inflation accelerates again. Let's say we had a birth pain of inflation. That was our warning. That was our birth pain in 2022. That birth pain subsides just a little bit. And if it comes back again, then you're going to see the bond market in trouble, and then you're going to see stocks in trouble too. And then you're going to see commodities start to take off more than likely. And then that further exacerbates the inflationary pressures that are underneath there. And now you've got, you know, companies like Starbucks, where they've missed sales relatively dramatically, right? And I know a lot of people that's their treat for the day is to go to Starbucks. And when you start to see the consumer cut back in those areas, and you talked about McDonald's earlier, I don't know if we did that here before, but McDonald's, you know, missing their sales, you're starting to see that behavior change. And then that, you know, inflationary pressures come into corporate, profits are squeezed. And that's why when you had that big decline in 1973, the market went from, you know, general price of price to earnings ratio of 20 at that time back to undervalued at 10 by the time that decline was over. That was the point that you wanted to be aggressive in buying investments, because that was the bottom of the market going forward. So, you know, that's my concern, is that this is going to be a devastating environment for those who think that the status what's worked for the past 20 years is going to continue to work in this environment. You know, and humans are slow to change. They're slow to adapt, and corporate institutions and the institutionalization of the investment process, you know, that cookie cutter approach is certainly going to be slow to change.
Yeah, but this is, you know, you break it, you buy it. I think the Fed broke the markets a while ago. They broke the pricing mechanism as we've discussed for commodities and things like that. But as well, they broke, there used to be a relationship. I used to follow this thing, which was a measure of the earnings yield of stocks compared to the Fed funds rate. And so that's the dividend rate. So that ratio, you know, it would tell you when one was getting a little ahead of the other, and it was pretty reliable. And then it just broke down starting post Great Financial Crisis, where we had this earnings expansion multiple expansion, where people were like 15, you know, 10 is a bargain, 7's a bargain, 10's pretty good, 15 is like, okay, long-term historical 18, 15, 18. But then we were living with 20s and 22s and 25s and 26s. And now people don't even think twice buying into, again, not specific investment advice for or against, but NVIDIA, PE of 76 right now, right? And it's just like, what? They have to either grow like a supernova, or you have to wait 76 years to get your money back by the company. It's just not doesn't make sense, right? So, but I could show you a screen. I could run a screen on FinViz right now, Paul, where you ask, only show me companies worth more than $1 billion with PEs over 200. And you'll get screen after screen, after screen, you know?
You know, and that reminds me, you know, Amazon, you go back to that stock in the year 2000, investors were correct to see where we are today and what that new technology and that new business model was going to do. But when, you know, when the bubble burst in the year 2000, it was 11, 12 years later, if my memory is correct, approximately 11, 12 years later, where it endured a 50% decline and another 40% decline. And ultimately today, Amazon has been a ridiculously good investment. But people overestimated, and that euphoria gets in there. And that's really good for the institutions, because when you've got insiders that have a retail environment that's hungry to purchase based on a narrative that they don't know how to put the math to, you know, it becomes narrative. It becomes a popularity contest. They feel good because that's what their friends are doing. They feel good because that's what CNBC is talking about it all the time. And the institutions feel good because they have a market to be able to sell their overpriced stocks to.
Well, there has to be a bag holder. There has to be.
Yeah. So I know that's a little dark, but that's, you know, and being a little cynical, but being in this industry for 26 years, you see that happen over and over and over again. So, yeah. You know, but the question is, you know, institutions are patient, right? They'll plan 3-4 years ahead, and they're not worried if they underperform something for a 24-month period of time, because they'll put themselves in a position to be able to buy those assets back when the bag holder starts to puke them or is forced out of them.
Yep. Hey, do you have any explanation for this one? Which is, this is the difference, a year-over-year change comparison between median sales price of houses sold, comparing it to the Case-Shiller index, which is also supposed to be median sales price of houses sold. Obviously, these two methods track each other very closely over time, and this goes back to 1988. Hmm. And then this little departure here, where Case-Shiller's reporting a 6.8% increase, but the other methodology is reporting a 12% decline. I don't know how to account for such a massive, I mean, obviously methodological error. Somebody's making the error here, but do you have any insights on this one?
No, I don't. And I've been really curious. I've been trying to figure out what's going on there, because I've seen a couple of reports that are saying, hey, you know, the average home price, median home price sells down 15%, but I've not been able to put that together anywhere else. And I'm not familiar enough with either with the components in that chart to give an educated guess. So bottom line, I don't know. That I'm looking through the chart and I see a few deviations in there in the past, but nothing like that. So I don't know.
No, that's the biggest ever.
Any educated guess as to what that would be?
So median's usually better, because that just median means half more, half less. Mm-hmm. So it's not, I wondered if maybe Case-Shiller wasn't doing some more averaging, because you could easily make a case for why you have higher average house prices right now, because an average takes, if you sold almost nothing below 400,000, you were just selling $1 million properties, that drags the average up, right? Whereas it might not drag the median up. So, I don't know. I don't really have a good case for that, but I'm watching this because, you know, as goes housing, kind of goes the economy, and I'm watching for a recession. I truly believe there is a recession on the way. I'm tracking that in a number of fronts. Housing is always front and center. It's like one of the biggest stool legs on the economy, because it drives so much, right? The house sales themselves, but then all the derivative things. There's the moving costs and getting new flooring and putting in dishwashers and all the consumptive behaviors that come with house sales. So I have been seeing, but it's very anecdotal. People have been posting like Redfin or Zillow's of areas, and you just see that inventory is really starting to spike. Okay. In a lot of these areas that have been gotten posted. So it's anecdotal. I don't have good national data for this yet. I've just seen some signs that people are saying, hey, my locality seems to be experiencing a sudden surge in homes available for sale, which is coincident usually with prices starting to decline.
Correct.
And our lag area, there, but
yeah, in our area, I've seen a lot more land for sale right now. New construction costs have just accelerated dramatically, but $1 million plus homes are back to full offer and a little bit over from the reports that I'm hearing here recently. But that's not necessarily the case for the few homes that are under the $500,000 price range. You know, those are not moving as fast from what I'm hearing. So, it's an interesting market. I'm curious about that data. That was a good educated guess. It makes sense that that could be the deviation, but I'm not familiar in that case.
Well, there's somehow their methodologies have peeled off from each other. So,
yeah, that deviation is important. It really is, because it tells us there's something, there's an imbalance somewhere. I just don't know what the calculation behind it would be.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I get these questions a lot back at Peak Prosperity in our forum area. Subscribers chew on this quite a bit, Paul, which is, should I stay or should I go? Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, as the grass is always seems a little greener, people are generally, you know, I would say unhappy with where they currently live for all sorts of reasons. But it comes down to number one thing, which is there aren't enough people around me who think my way for me to feel like comfortable, right? Mm-hmm. You know? And I haven't found yet that there's a hot spot where you can go to, like, oh yeah, go to Paraguay. That's where all the cool people are hanging out with the Mormons and the Mennonites, you know, it's all happy down there, you know,
that's true.
I haven't seen it. So, but it's just interesting, because a big part of that is just thinking that somehow there's going to be a different result somewhere else. I don't think that's the case. I think local mileage can vary somewhat. I certainly wouldn't want to be in an inner city area. I wouldn't want to be in Oakland. I wouldn't want to be in New Orleans for what I see coming next. That's not my cup of tea. No. I wouldn't choose to tough that out, but other people would. But I don't know. I don't really see a huge advantage at this stage, because I can't predict anymore.
Right. Right. Well, when you've got the government that's obvious that's manipulating to the data for their own benefit, and they're supported in that by the basic media structure that's behind them, it's really hard to determine the truth. And that, you know, finding the truth behind the data right now is the most valuable thing that we can come up, that we can discover. But it is a dark room when you're trying to find the truth right now, and it makes it nearly impossible to make really educated guesses. The only thing we can fall back on is the few things that we can track that at least at this point are not as manipulated as heavily as other things are.
Best horse, I mean, at the glue factory kind of thing.
Yeah. But you know, that reminds me where you go back to that. I can't remember all the details, but you shared it not too long ago where corporate earnings, is it corporate earnings? If I remember correctly, because this just mm-hmm. came to mind and I'm trying to pull all that data up, but could be a matter of national security where they could basically lie for national security. Right. So, you know, and they don't give us a definition of what that could be. Well, you know, is that to keep the markets looking good as long as possible so that we can stay in power? I don't know. But 2 + 2 does, you know, maybe the education, our math, the math education in our system so bad that everybody thinks that 2 + 2 = 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9, but not 4. Things just don't add up, you know, when you really dig into the data.
Yeah. That's why I was asked in an interview earlier today, somebody said, make it simple. And I said, oh, that's easy. Bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, right? Yeah. Right. You either own it or you don't. Ownership is control is 10/10 of the law, right? Mm-hmm. When you get down to this. And so I do think that, you know, at times like this, Paul, where I can't analyze, I don't trust the data. I know they're lying. They know I know they're lying and all of that. I get very defensive in those modes, right? Because I don't know what else to do. If you don't know where the risks lie, it's very hard to make an intelligent response to that. That's just how I've been built.
I'll tell you something interesting that I've observed here recently that comes to mind, and I believe this is very important. Now, when I share this, it's not a recommendation to those out there. It's an observation. Obviously, it's an asset class that I like. I own gold, so full disclosure and everything that's in there. But, you know, from my point of view and looking at the instruments, you know, and I can go back and show this. We've talked about it before, but the breakout above resistance in gold, that was massive. Not only the breakout is a big deal, but the fact that we carried further than 3% above and we carried for several weeks with that acceleration. So, you know, imagine you're standing in a pool and you've got a beach ball held around your waist and you're playing a game that you want to keep that beach ball down there as long as you possibly can. Let's assume this level of the pool's accelerating quickly and it gets all the way up to your nose and, you know, you're trying to win the game, right? And all of a sudden you can't breathe anymore. So something has to give. You're either going to drown or you're going to let go of the ball, the beach ball. And when that thing, you know, comes out of your hand, you're artificially holding it down. It rises dramatically and bounces above that level and sets a new equilibrium. And, you know, you survive and win the game. Hopefully that's the case. But that's, from my perspective, that's what gold did when it broke out of that massive resistance level. Now, we haven't come back and tested that breakout level yet, but it's interesting because I've got some family and some friends and, you know, that they've been buyers of gold in the past, but I called one of them here recently and I don't think he'd care if I said who it was, but I called him and I was like, okay, I'm not going to say it anyway, but I said, so what do you think about the gold breakout? I was like, man, that's just way too high. I'm glad it's higher, but there's no way we're going to buy any more right now. And I start laughing. I'm like, you know, now I don't know what's going to happen, but I can tell you this, in my personal opinion, if it pulls back, you know, that's a good opportunity because we have enough information right now. And I go to explain, everything has been stacked against gold in this situation. So something's changed. We don't know what that is. That's one of the things I like about price action in the market. That price action tells us, you know, really shouldn't have happened with the backdrop. So that tells us that something has changed behind the scenes. And I believe that means the path of least resistance for that price is higher. But again, like so many of these things that break out, even the investors who like it are frozen at this point. It's like, gosh, it's been this high. We've had our, you know, we've had hope in the past, right? But we didn't have this massive breakout above resistance. We had a breakout of minor resistance and people would get excited about buying it because it was below those all-time highs. It gets really hard to buy something when it breaks out above all-time highs. And I've learned over the years to not hesitate, right? I don't know what it's going to do in the next 3, 4, 5, 6 months, but there's a high probability that 24 months from now that that price is going to be substantially higher because somebody out there became price insensitive and knew that they were going to drive it out to all-time highs and create extra competitors for those that are paying attention to those things. But they saw something in the system, whatever that may be, that made them decide not to wait for a potential pullback. And historically, when you have stocks that have these basing patterns for periods of time and they hit this resistance and they hit this resistance, it ends up being like that basketball. It might break out, go above that beach ball. It might break out, go above the water and settle back down. But you've established a higher level of equilibrium where it can go up over time. So, you know, it's interesting to me that there's that much cynicism. U.S. investors aren't chasing it. You know, this is a big deal, in my opinion, from a long-term perspective, and nobody seems to be excited about it except for a handful of people. And that's how major bull markets take off, right? That's how major bull markets begin. So I'm not making that prediction because I've been wrong on predictions before, but I can say with a educated guess that's a big deal from a long-term standpoint. And I think there's going to be a lot of people, not a recommendation, y'all. I'm just sharing for educational purposes to challenge you to think. Go see a professional, look at your situation so that you're not doing something ridiculous. But I think in the future, people are going to look back and go, you know, I wish I hadn't hesitated then. Just because it was at all-time highs doesn't mean, I mean, how many people are chasing NVIDIA at the top now because they ignored it when it broke out of was at all-time highs before? But when it's common knowledge and your neighbors are chasing it and people are bragging about it, for whatever reason, that's what investors and their human behavior, the weakness in our human behavior, that's when they feel the most comfortable buying it. Very few people feel comfortable buying it when it's the unpopular thing. But from my perspective, that's a big deal. And all I'm waiting for right now is I'm looking, okay, when is silver going to break out? When is silver going to, it's not giving us that major breakout yet, but you know, when that day comes, you know, that'll be a big deal too, to follow behind.
Absolutely. You know, a couple of things there. So a lot of people want to know, like, what's the sure thing? You know, I'm going to invest in this and it's going to go up 100%. That's not how it works.
No.
60-40. If you can bat 60-40, you win in this game, right?
That's right.
You know, so we play the odds here and you say, is there a 60%? Is there a 60-40 chance in my favor on this particular, you know, breakout being real? I think so, because it was November. I remember this explicitly because I chat with a lot of gold people on Twitter, X, and you know, somebody said, oh, look, this is going to be our first weekly close over 2000. And I said, someday it'll be our last weekly close.
Good statement, you know, Chris. You're right.
Right. Yeah. You know, and we won't see that. And we haven't seen it since then, actually. So that was true. But, and then someday it'll be a weekly close over 2,500, then 3,000, off we go and things like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what I like about gold as well at this point, again, not investment advice, but there were so many breakdowns. Paul, I watched that market like a hawk and I'm very familiar with things. I can tell you that the correlation between the price of gold and the inverse of positive real rates has been just like the rule. Like if you wanted to know where is gold, all you had to understand was where are positive real rates and the inverse of that. So as positive real rates are falling, gold is climbing, vice versa. Right. But you chart them together on an inverse scale and they're just, and then about 2022, they did this. They just broke decades of a relationship. So I can't tell you exactly what, but I can tell you that several decade old relationship broke.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that's
what was that all about?
That's something that was said. Well, not said. I mean, I was trying to come up with a brilliant analogy there and it ended up failing completely. So that's something that's very important, right? That's very important to pay attention to, that those relationships are broken, because that means something in the market has changed. Behavior has changed. And those institutions are ones that are looking long-term. They're patient. They don't care about what their neighbors are doing. They're paying attention to where the ball's going, not where it is today. And that's our job as, you know, to advise investors, is to help them take that hard path. Be disciplined, be patient, do the research, know why you're owning something, understand the strengths and weaknesses of your strategy. That's what I spend a lot of time trying to talk to people. This is what it can do. This is what it can't do. so that you have the fortitude to walk that journey. Because if you're going to where the ball is going to be, you're taking the path less traveled and the herd joins you at some point in the future. But that's not an easy path, right? That's a path that takes discipline in a society that so hungers for instant gratification and is so affirmed by instant gratification. Because in our society today, if you get people who get instant gratification feel really smart, right? But it's those who end up in the right place who look smart in the end, because they end up being wise. It's not just smart, it's wise, who are taking that path less traveled and maneuvering to where the ball's going to be. And they don't get it every time. Like you said, 60% of the time, right? And the way we look at it in the risk management process, let your winners run. And if you have something that the information changes, cut your losses quickly and move on somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And that's a hard thing for people to do sometimes. But that you stack your winners a lot higher when you let your winners run and you're cutting your losses real quick. So overall, if you're batting 60-40, I'm not saying this is the statistic, but as an example, if 60% of your decisions are 20% winners and 40% of your losers are 5% losers, well, then you're having some pretty good returns there. Now, that's an extreme example for those listening out there. I'm not saying what that is. I just picked numbers off the top of my head. But for teaching purposes, that's why it's important to cut your losses and move on. Those are sunk costs. When the information changes, if you're down a little bit, move on, because there's something else that's better out there.
Well, I agree. And I'm a contrarian investor, so I have an easy time doing the opposite of other folks. So when I'm down at my local coffee shop and people are suddenly start talking all about gold, I'm probably cashing out, right? But we are so many, nobody's talking about it. Nobody, like, it's not, they wouldn't even, I could put a gold coin on the counter and be safe. Like, nobody would even know what's happening, right? Except for some guys over the age of 80, maybe they would know. But, you know, other than that, I think it would be pretty much safe. So the other thing I do as a contrarian, though, Paul, is I'm watching both for the positive and the negative space in the story. So the positive space is the price of gold. But there's this other stuff, which is like, wait a minute, there was some really weird creaking, popping sounds coming out of that market. And I see the same stuff coming out of silver, different story, not investment advice, but there's weirdness going on there. But another big thing was, if this is the price of gold and this is the amount of gold tonnage that was sitting in the GLD tracking trust, they would go up and down together, which makes sense because GLD has to track the price of gold. So the price of gold goes up, it has to actually own more gold and so on. Again, they're doing this for a long time. And then in 2022, they just separated from each other.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that deserves talking about, because you have to scratch your head and go, well, how many things could cause massive quantities? I mean, we're talking tens of millions of ounces of gold to leave a tracking trust as the price of gold is spiking higher.
Yeah.
There's not that many good explanations for that one, you know?
And where's it going? Where's it going? Is it going east and it'll never come back? Or it'll never be able to be, the West will not be able to afford to purchase it and pull it back, you know? Where's it going? That's a good question. That's something that I've been looking at too. And
that's where I sit up and take notice. What's that old joke? If you walk into the bathroom and your cat's in there and it lifts its head up, be careful. That means there's a bar of soap on the floor and it wants to see what happens next, right?
That's right. That's good. That's good. So, you know, we're in an interesting period of time right now. You know, I'm curious to see how the market's like. I really enjoy looking at them every day and just seeing the price action and what's unfolding. Now, because of what our tools, and they're not perfect, right? They're going to struggle at the turns. That's why it's not designed to pick the top and the bottom. But, you know, the question in my mind is this a turn? Or are we going to get kind of the thesis that's out there, hey, we're due a correction and we're going to get one more run into the summer? Looks like the Fed's trying to generate that one extra run into the summer. But this is a fascinating period of time. It's a period of time over the next several years that those investors who are courageous and adaptive are going to put themselves in a position to really take advantage of the distortions that are out there. Because in some categories, I mean, we're looking at once in 15, 16 year opportunities, right? I mean, there's so many categories out there that are unpopular that are ridiculously attractive.
I didn't see this coming. This is live while we're recording this. We're doing this on Wednesday. It's coming in on the end of the market hour, so it's 3:54. You and I, while we were talking, the Fed came out, flapped its gums. The S&P shot up to plus 52 points. While we were talking, Paul, the S&P shed all of that and is actually slightly negative. I'm surprised by that. And these two, in terms of signs, these are the kinds of things that I'm an old dog, see the gray hair. Market tops and market bottoms are really jumpy affairs, right? Mm-hmm. You get things spike up, things spike down. They get really sort of very jumpy, both at both tops and bottoms, to the extent that we still have bottoms. We don't really have them anymore. we have V's instead of bottoms, but that's okay. But this is the kind of stuff where again, I just look at it and go, what is that telling me? There's a little something going on here.
Well, I'll share something here if you want to see something that I'm paying attention to that's really,
yes, please.
It's really interesting to me. Now, this is a long-term chart. It won't be resolved until the end of the year, but it is relatively fascinating. So before I show it, I'll share that background. You remember the analogy I was using about the beach ball being held under the water. Okay, so that's resistance at the top level. So what I'm going to share here is, let me get my screen right. Okay, I've got it up. Okay. Can you see my screen there, Chris?
Sure can.
Okay. So this is the S&P 500 large cap index, and it's a yearly candlestick. So each one of these represents the price action in a year. So opening value here, closing value, the low and the high. So we've been on this trend line going back to 2009. Okay. So this has been a pretty steady trend. We had a little bit of a dip in the low for the year in 2020 down here, but we closed above it. So, you know, that just gives you the ranges, the opening, the close, the high and the low during that period of time. But notice for 3 years, we struggled up here at the top with this resistance that went back to 2021. So that was the high, you know, the high. So we failed at that level. Now, so far this year, we've broken above. Now that's a pretty big deal if we close above that. But I'm curious, you know, what would also be a big deal is if we end up closing below that level at the end of the year and then break that trend line. To me, that's going to be the sign that this run is over, and that things are going to be, you know, the major path of downside, major path of least resistance is going to be the downside. Now, you know, you're 5,000 on the S&P, you've got to get all the way down to 4,200 before you actually break that. Now, that's a lot of pain. So we wouldn't necessarily, you know, wait that long before we made some indication. But I would certainly, you know, be in a position to allocate if we were to hold that and go higher. So I'm curious to see what's going to happen, but I've been, you know, watching this. This is something that you look at, you know, it's a long term. So it's going to be December 31st before this is resolved. But, you know, and paying attention to some of the things that are taking place, that's a longer term chart that I'm looking at. Your intermediate term charts, which are your 3 month and your 6 month, all of those are showing critical points, right? That if we fail at this level, things could go down a lot more than anybody's expecting out there, especially the average individual that's believing that the Fed can bail them out.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe they can. Maybe they can't. We don't know.
Yeah.
So, hey, with that, for anybody who's interested in talking with Paul and his amazing team at Kiker Wealth Management, please just come to peakfinancialinvesting.com. You fill out a simple form, and somebody will get in touch with you post-haste. And again, Paul, thanks for doing what you do, just getting the most amazing feedback from people out there who really love your service, including my daughter's boyfriend. He was just raving about you the other day.
I was thinking about him the other day because I was looking over a couple of things. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, well, what he said was that there's a lot of trust. He just trusts you. And that's a big thing for him, and he considers himself to be, you know, an important, good judge of that. So anyway, love that. And, so that's really a wonderful thing. So thanks for helping out. And I know he's been really steered well by you so far. It makes a lot of sense to him. So
thank you.
He's excited. He's actually excited. I think finance was investing was a little scary, and now it's mm-hmm. been converted into excitement. So that's a good service you got there.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, and every now and then I get pushback because the reason I tell people we'll do an introductory call and then we do a planning meeting. And I'll get pushbacks like, hey, you've told me everything that I want to know at this point, but I want to work together. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, no, I really want to spend the time educating you so you know why we're doing what we're doing. So just in the past 3 weeks, it's been a while since somebody said this, but you know, somebody made the comment, said, look, I have learned more in the 2 hours that we've taught between the, you know, introduction call and then the planning meeting. I've learned more in the past 2 hours than I have in my relationship that I've had for the past 12 years. That's because we take the time to show them the reason why. And the planning, it lengthens the process. There's no instant gratification in it for us or the client, right? There is once I get done with it, but I'm able to show them, okay, here's your risks. This is what can take you out. Here's some strategies that can, you know, can protect against worst case scenario. But the strengths of those strategies are going to give you the weaknesses over here, you know, and then we get into all kinds of things, and it's simple. It's easy to understand. And I love teaching, right? That's what it is. Teach people why they need to be in the position they're in, not just fill out an institutionalized questionnaire. And then that way they understand. And what I have found is investor behavior is far better over the long term, because if they're absolutely scared of volatility, right, because they don't understand why they need to be invested more aggressively, then if they, once they know why and they know that you have a risk management protocol in place, then all of a sudden they're not losing sleep over that volatility because they know the triggers that are going to help protect them if things turn the other way. And they know that they need that volatility if that's the case for their circumstances to give them the highest probability of success. So I love doing it. Get a little geeky about it, but thanks for sharing that, Chris, because I love it. It's great being able to help people. And I'm telling you, the people that I'm meeting through your following network across this country, I mean, they're genuinely good, wonderful people who care about this country. They care about their families, and they're ridiculously intelligent and informed. And they're some of the most fun conversations I've had. So it's an honor to meet anybody that calls in, and I love it. So thanks, Chris.
Oh, fantastic. So glad to be in this relationship with you around that. That's just absolutely wonderful. And someday we're going fishing.
Yes.
I still see that trout over your shoulder. And
oh, I love the trout fishing. I've not done much of it here recently. I was hoping we were going to be able to work it out where you and I
know,
could go there
I know.
For a period of time. So yeah. Maybe this fall, if we can work it out around November, that's a prime time up here in North Georgia. And some of the biggest fish that I have landed have been in that November window, just monster brown trout. I'm not going to give our secret place away, even though people could find it, but fishing's good. So yep. Maybe one of these years I'll get you down here around November.
Yeah. Well, fantastic. Looking forward to that. So until next time, thanks, Paul. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you next week with our next edition of Finance U.
See you then.
Hello, Chris Martinson. I'm the CEO of Peak Prosperity and also Peak Financial Investing. And after watching that, you're probably wondering, well, what do I do with my money? Look, you both deserve and need somebody who can talk to you about what's really going on in this world, understand the situation as it is, not be steering you towards certain things that don't make sense for you or just keep you in a game that's already ended. Look, if you want to talk to somebody about the petrodollar declining or what is happening with gold or which sectors are actually the best ones to be in, given what the Federal Reserve is up to or the federal government, you deserve to talk to somebody who can answer those and has a few gray hairs and has been there through some of the economic cycles because, hey, we're in another economic cycle, so it's good to have that experience. Fortunately, at Peak Financial Investing, what we do is we go out and we scour and we look for the very best firms out there who satisfy one thing above all else. They've got great experience coupled to great customer service. So if you want to come by peakfinancialinvesting.com, there's a very simple form you can fill out. Just a few fields. You hit send. What happens is an email gets triggered out. It goes to an endorsed firm of ours. You will get an email back. You can then set up a phone call for a 30 to 45 minute free, no obligation, no pressure call to find out if this firm is a good fit for you and to find out if you're a good fit for the firm. It has to go both ways. And if all that matches up, this will be one of the best things that could happen to you this year. So please come by peakfinancialinvesting.com. Very simple process. We would love to help you if we can. Thanks very much.